Trait number 7 in the psychology of winning is positive self-direction. And positive self-direction is purpose. And purpose is specificity. And specificity is incremental. By the inch, a cinch. By the yard, gets hard. Group support, company, family, team, nation, city, gotta have it. Weight Watchers. Ceremonialized, every permanent change in our life is a ceremony. Birth, school, graduation, death, marriage, engagement, contest winner. We're ceremonial. We cling in groups of masterminds supporting each other. We go through the incremental gain, and then we reach just out of reach but not out of sight. But we are specific and we specify our goals because we know that the mind is teleological, target-seeking. I made a mistake. In 1960, I went to a program like this. I was 27 years old. I sat in the room. We went through the exercise. They said, "How much money do you need?" I said, "Enough." My robot goes, "Huh? What's that?" I said, "Enough is enough. Enough to keep me happy." He said, "You should be happy without the money." I said, "I'd like peace on earth." He said, "Piece of pie, piece of bread, piece of what?" I said, "P-E-A-C-E." He said, "There won't be any peace, so there's a piece of mouse in every piece of bread in every mouth. There'll be no peace on earth till there's a piece of bread in every mouth." I said, "I'd like to retire." He said, "Horizontal in a pine box with a lily in your hand." I said, "I would like to keep pace with inflation." He didn't know what it would be. I said, "I would like financial security." He said, "Define it." And I said, "Financial security is having sufficient income from my assets not to have to depend upon day-to-day work." And he said, "How much would that be?" But I said, when I was 27, 20 years ago, that I'd like to find myself. And I found myself 47, 20 years later. No closer to reaching any goal because I didn't have it. I never quite got down to doing anything except to set my vacations, which are very simple. It was easy to plan a place to go and all the tickets and the clothes. That was simple, and so was Christmas. And so was a party. And then when it got down to planning my life, I fell apart. But I planned my business because you have to in business, but not my life. I majored in minors. I did things that were tension relieving. I shuffled papers. I let it happen. And 20 years went by in 1980. That's only 20 years. And now the year 2000 rolls around. A sneeze, a turn of the head, 5 skiing trips, a couple of trips to the reef, and you're there. Purpose. If you don't have one, your system will set one for you. Get through the day. Just have enough energy to watch TV. The most important thing I've ever found is that if you plan to fail, then fail to plan, and beginning is half done. Beginning anything is half done. The New York Times said, "What's your purpose?" I said, "My purpose is to write a new book." And they said, "What's it called?" And I stumbled, and I threw one out, The Winner's Edge. They said, "How many pages would it be?" And I said, "It's your average book. It's just enough. I'd like to do better than last year. I'd like to get ahead." And the New York Times said to me last year, "How many pages?" And I said, "How many would you like?" And they said, "For $10.95, we'd like about 300. If you want an $8.95, we'd like about 260. So how many would you like?" And I said, "280. And they said, "Good, you have a 280-page book. How many chapters is it?" And I said, "I got 10 points. Maybe I'll make it 10 chapters. And they said, "Good, a 10-chapter, 280-page book. How many pages in each chapter? 28. Okay, we got that. How many chapters can you give us this week?" I said, "I can't give you any. I haven't started yet." And they said, "How many can you give us when you start it?" I said, "I don't know how many pages I can write a night." And they said, "Figure it out." So I figured it out, and it took me 11 weeks to write the book, finally. I had been planning it for 7 years. In 11 weeks, I wrote it by giving it a purpose, specifying the number of pages, the number of chapters, the number of pages per day, and it became a page per every other day project. The increments were set. The group support was my family, a librarian, a stenographer, and some other authors. And they kept me from watching television. My stenographer said, "Where's the rough copy?" The librarian said, "Here's the books." My family said, "No football for you tonight." Why? Because I'd set a ceremony. I told my family I'd take them to Australia and go to the barrier reef when my book was published. And they turned my television set off. And now I've brought them to Australia with my new book that has not yet been published, and they have to read it, because that's their payoff. And they have to read it before they go to the reef. I've been studying purpose now, and if I were to give any seminar in the world, I would give one on purpose. I studied the Holocaust. Viktor Frankl, V-I-K-T-O-R-F-R-A-N-K-L. The book, Man's Search for Meaning. What does it mean? It means logotherapy, goal therapy, purpose. He was a Jewish psychiatrist in Auschwitz, in Dachau. He lost his family, immediately exterminated, nothing to live for. Oh no, life does not give you something to live for. It asks you what your accountability is. Life itself asks you what you're going to do for it. The gift has been given already in your own life. The prisoners in Auschwitz, 1 in 20, made it through. Those with no goal died quickly and easily, 19 out of 20. Nothing to live for, you can't blame them. Making lampshades and pulling their gold out of their teeth, what could they do? But Viktor Frankl led the resistance movement and has given me my cause for self-direction. He told some, "Who among you would live?" 386 raised their hand. He said, "Good, you'll be the ones to get the justice. You're the revenge department. What you will do is remember their names, faces, and everything about them, so when it comes to trial, you'll have the facts. Is it agreed that you will live?" They live for revenge, the strongest of any purpose. That's one of the emotional survival instincts, the ability to get justice or to go back at. It's a negative goal, but it's a goal. Who among you would like to go back to some beautiful country and retire in Perth or be in some beautiful land and have fishing and fun? Another 200 raised their hands. "We would like to go to a country." They made a password, which was their password like Ishmael. With that password, it made no difference whether they ate. They beat and starved them. It makes no difference when you have the password of purpose. It's the obsession of the currently dominant thought. Psychosomatically, it makes it happen, the target. Who among you would like to live for 12 months, a time priority goal? Why? The Allies are coming in 12 months, pass the word. Those who lived because of 12-month time priority, get back to the homeland, or get justice, a goal. Switch to the Korean War and study the prisoners. The Chinese are brilliant. They know how to interrogate salesmen. They know how to find out leaders. They can talk to children. They know how to talk to Americans, especially American servicemen who've been drafted with no clear cause. It's easy to turn a coat. If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Therefore, how easy is it to turn a coat? Very simple. Find out what the specificity is. Find out what the conviction is. You'll find out the mettle of the man and woman. "Hi, soldier, where are you from?" "I'm from Los Angeles." "Well, what are you going to do when you get back?" I don't know." "Well, you got a girl back home?" "No, she probably left me." "Who's your favorite ball team?" I don't know." "Well, what are you fighting for?" "I got drafted." We know that." How much money would you like?" "Enough." I'm not sure." "Good, don't worry about it." "Not necessary. Not a worry. Put them in the minimum security camp and we'll retrain him." That's called being able to hire away easily from your present job for the next dole. Now, the soldiers in the Korean War, interrogated but like jelly beans, purposeless, purposeful, purposeless, purposeful, were put in a country club with no guard dogs, no barbed wire, better food. The death rate went up 300%. The disease rate was twice, 10 times as high. They threw their buddies out in the snow to freeze. They got more chow in one line, so the other ones thought they compromised, so they threw him out to freeze in the snow. They didn't know who was compromising whom. Easy to do without conviction and purpose. I watched that. I couldn't believe not a one of them escaped or even tried. They pulled the covers up over their head and died, though, 22, 23-year-old boys. Switched to the other ones. Hi, soldier, where are you from? I'm from Perth, Australia. Is that right? Interestingly enough, in World War II, the Bataan March, the Aussies were among the strongest of all, the people that don't give in to interrogation. Why? Fierce independence and conviction, a fierce desire to maintain and keep their independent convictions to themselves. Where are you from? Perth, huh? What are you going to do when you get back? I'm going into mining. Is that right? How much money do you think you're worth? $25,000 a year, probably. Is that right? You going to go to school? Yeah, I got that plan. You have a girl back home? Yeah, we're getting married next year. Who's your favorite ball team? You know, the West Australian footballers, that's me. Who are they? Yeah, that's who they are, all right. I hope you got that on television. That's who they are. You know, the thing I don't like about you, soldier, is you're a leader. This guy we can't train. Stick him in the stockade. Where did they put him in a cage? Bamboo, 5x5, not able to stand up, not able to really lie down because it's 5 feet wide, 5 feet tall. Beat him with the hose, get him cold, get him quiet, keep him awake, get him relaxed, get him exhausted. When you take a hostage, keep the lights on. I'll put a gun to their head and pull the trigger, but don't have any bullets in it. Keep them off balance, and maybe you can biofeedback, reorient, suggestology, change their training. They couldn't, though. They couldn't break them, not a one of them. What did they do? Well, they crawled out and dug out and got back to where they belonged, their target. You can't take a leader who's specific and do that because they're convinced that they're going somewhere. The other people are subject to the ill fate or fair wind. It's like a ship without a rudder. I think I'll go sailing. Where are you going? I don't know, just around. A sea captain doesn't know what's going to happen on the way, but he sets the course. The autopilot takes over when he sets it in. Then comes the wind, the tide. He doesn't see the destination for 90% of the voyage, but he goes from one port to another in advance, planning. The other people run aground. Maybe they'll find a rich port, maybe they won't. I don't like to live that way. There's too little time. Not you and I. You and I take a look at the ceremonial aspects, the group support, the incrementalism of it, the specificity of it, and we understand this purpose. My daughter understood it only too well, 9 years old. She said, "Do you mean if you get a picture of it, if you can smell it, taste it, touch it, if you get the scrapbook on it, if you really want it, and you go to the person who can get it for you, you'll get it?" And I said, "Absolutely, it's autopilot." The next day there was a silver dish on the floor. I stubbed my toe on it. I said, "What's that?" She said, "My dog's dish." I said, "You're not getting a dog, end of goal." I said, "There's always a managing director to deal with in this world, and I'm yours. And one thing about goal setting, it must be realistic for the group. And dogs don't compute." But her robot had had dog put in over and over again when she was relaxed at bedtime, evidently during prayer. The next day there was a long chain with a red handle on it. I said, "People think we're weird already. I don't want you going outside with nothing on the end of that chain." She said, "There's something on the end of it." I said, "Tell me about it." She said, "It's a dog. I said, you're not getting it. She said, I'll tell you about it anyway. His name is Khemo, K-H-E-E-M-O, short for Khemosabe, which means friend in Indian. He's a Malamute. He's black with white markings, a diamond on his forehead, brown paws. He's got clear eyes. And Dad, you'll love him. Here's the book on care and feeding. I said, where is he? And she said, I don't know, but he's there somewhere. I said, well, honey, I hate to discourage you, but they shed. They should pull sleds in Denver, and you're in Southern California. You can forget about a sled dog in California panting and shedding in the house. No dogs, sorry, and they smell. And she said, they do. They smell better than humans do. They smell, they have good noses. And I said, don't try to know. The next day was Father's Day. It had been a setup all along. I came downstairs like Norm, walking down with my bathrobe and my pennies in my hand. Father's Day is my day, not their day. What did I see? No breakfast, no lunch, just a one ad on my plate. One AKC Malamute pup, drive by today, $500, last one. Children all dressed, standing in a row.
I want to watch the ball game, one of the best of the year. They say, Happy Father's Day, here's your card, don't you want to take your children for a drive on Father's Day? I said, heck no, I'm not going, it's my day, but I'm going to not do it. I'm watching the ball game, and they said, the cat's in the cradle, and the man in the moon. And we're going to grow up just like you, Dad. And when you want us to come over to see you on Father's Day, when we have our children, we'll be watching the ball game and won't be able to see you either. I said, well, what? Why don't we go for a drive then? If you And we went, and I sat in the car and listened to the radio, and they played with this thing, so what? Have at it. What did he do? He walked through their legs, came down in the car, hopped up, licked my shoe, pulled my pant leg. He knew who his master was. I said, come on, Khemo, let's go home. The heck with the kids. Me and my dog go home. He comes through the screen door. It's locked. He eats my shoes, the lawn furniture, and he's nearsighted because he's a snow sled dog. They don't have to see where they're going. He eats a Persian rug, which has a snow goose in the center, thinking it's a turkey. I make him spit it out, and I sew it carefully with the children there back into the center of my wife's good Persian rug, and we sit quietly waiting for a return from the market. She said, what happened to the rug? I said, nothing. We were just playing on it, and it's just gotten a little out of shape. Don't worry about it. It'll be okay tomorrow. She vacuumed and sucked the center out of it. I said, they don't stand up under environmental conditions much anymore. And she said, your dog did it. And I said, her dog did it. And she said, you got it. And I said, she thought it. It's happened to me every time. Of all the things I know, purpose is the key. People die on purpose. People die because of no purpose. I've seen people say, I just want to get back to my homeland. I saw Edgar Bergen, our great ventriloquist, say to his daughter, I'm tired now. I'm going to do nothing for the rest of my life. And he was dead in 9 hours. Because that marvelous target, there are two great tragedies in life. Never to have had one, and ever to have reached it, the ultimate goal. Everything is a target just out of reach. I look at self-direction, and here's what I see. I see lifetime goals, long-range goals. I see a goal that if your children were to write a book about you, they would take your library book down and read several chapters that were your long-range goals. They'd read a scenario about your 5 to 10 year chapters. And that would be your long-range purpose in life that you'd defend fiercely to the end. Then I'd move to short-range goals because I'd work from the year 2000 backward, and knowing what I wanted in 20 years, it would be easier then to plan the short range. And I'd plan them 1 to 3, about 1 to 3 years in length for a short-range plan, because sometimes 3 to 4 years are a college education, sometimes they're getting through a master's degree, and sometimes they're a position of apprenticeship to move you to the long range. So sometimes you do without in order to go for the long reward. Number three, I take the time priority goals, which I guess you'd call, well, I don't know what I'd call those. Maybe I'd call them objectives. My objectives for 1980 would be 6 months or 1 year in length, and I'd have a one-year objective to accomplish, looked at every half year. I'd move down to projects, and I'd make sure they were a monthly project that fit into my objectives that were time priority goals. And then I'd go to my programs, 1 week long. And I'd have my weekly calendar, 4 weeks of which were my project. And I'd look at my weekly program and made sure it was full of places to go and things to see and things to read and family to spend time with at night. But I'd spend almost all of my effort on a daily priority, those zillions of precious diamond and ruby minutes around the coffee pot, going to and from work, majoring in minors to do my daily task. Every winner I've ever met has a pad of paper that before their desk is clean the night before, they take that pad of paper and put down 15 items, 10. They put down priorities, A's, big, fat A priorities. The B's and C's are in their drawer for coffee time, but the A's are right in front. They clean their desk and put them down. They go home at night, and before they fall asleep at night with the music playing, they think about what a good day it was. They've already said goodnight to the children and told them they were special. And then they think about tomorrow and place it in its perspective. And if they haven't finished, they put it on their bedstand and finish off and sleep knowing that they have tomorrow on the way. They sleep soundly and easily because they know what their priorities are daily. And then they think about the ASAP as soon as possible. I used to make mistakes and set my character goals in time frames. You should have a series of character and personality goals that have no time limits, because that's the soonest you'll get them. I'd like to spend time with my children now. I want to be better to my wife with flowers and cards now. I'd like to be more empathic to people now, and so I set those goals. I spend time with my wife. I spend 10 to 15 minutes a night with children one-on-one. I do the kind of things that set my goals, and those are character goals as soon as possible. That's the way you and I are. The long range, short range, time priority, project, program, priority, as soon as possible. If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. If you agree that you get what you think of, then set your targets and work backwards. Purpose is the key. I've never met a winner that didn't know where he or she was going just about all the time. And even if it's wrong, then you can change and take that as experience and go ahead. And the key on goals is not to jump around. I look at Jack Nicklaus and he says to me, do one thing well and all the opportunities will open up to you if you can take a goal and complete it and do it well, because the power in doing something extremely well opens the horizon for everything. I used to be a jack of all trades, master of none, and now I'm specific and it's opening wide. I know how much money I'm going to make in 1981. I think I know in 1985. I certainly know that in the year 2000, I will be definitely 67 years old. I will have a home in Australia that I'll spend at least 3 months a year enjoying the fantastic coastline and ecology. I'll be in Colorado skiing another 3. That takes care of half a year. In 6 months, I'll spend time enjoying my children and their pursuits while I am having video cassettes for children, like the Muppets, come directly into their home and writing children's programs to build self-esteem at 67. You and I, what will our income be? It'll need to be about $78,000 a year if you'd like $2,000 or $3,000 a month in spendable income, because inflation by then will have taken it that high. What will our homes be worth? $500,000 apiece. Inflation will double every 5 to 7 years, but real estate always has, especially in the beautiful countries. You and I will all be millionaires for the most part, but all we need to do is add a zero onto what we had before. It's comfortable now because we preset it in advance, and it's comfortable when we reach it because we plan for it. The purpose, the target, the life. The next point, we're watching the time now. Well, here's an interesting thing before we go on to the next point. These questions that we answered, I took a young man, 10 years old. His name was Eric in Des Moines, Iowa. He said, "How come you're not working on yours in the workshop?" I said, "How come you're not doing yours?" He said, "They won't let me play." I said, "It's not play, it's life." I said, "Go ahead, Eric. What's your professional goal for 1980? He's a 10-year-old. He said, "I'd like to make $386. I said, "Is that what you'd like to do?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Okay. What's your personal goal for 1981? He said, "To go to Hawaii and build 4 space shuttle model aircraft." I said, "Okay." I shamed his father into taking him to Hawaii by announcing it in front of the group. So he had to take him. That was easy. From the $386 he made in 80, he easily could buy and pay part of his way, plus buy his models. I said, "What will you be in 1985, and what will your income be?" 10 years old. He said, "In 1985, I'll be 15. I'll be a sophomore in high school in the 10th grade. I'll be a science student, and I'll be dissecting frogs and building model airplanes. Those are what I like best, science and airplanes." I said, "How much money will you make?" All he did was take the 385 and multiply it times 5. He didn't know what else to do, but he did anyway, and said about $1,700. And I said, "That's not too bad for 1985. $1,700 is pretty good. Let me ask you this, Eric. Where will you be in the year 2000? He said, "How old will I be?" I said, "20 plus 10 is 30. He said, "30 years old. 30 years old. He said, "I think I'll be in Houston. My major accomplishment will be that I'll be an astronaut. I'll be going back and forth into space, taking packages up from companies and sticking them into orbit. My assets financially in the year 2000, I'll have a lot of debt. I'll be in debt." And I said, "Well, what makes you think that?" He said, "My parents said you can't get ahead nowadays and that you're in debt." Well, we'll all be in debt. There was a boy at 10 who did what I could never get around to doing, except I heard Neil Armstrong say, "Ever since I was 12, I dreamed I'd do something important in aviation." And I thought about Anwar Sadat, imprisoned at age 22 in cell 54, mistakenly in a plot to kill King Farouk, imprisoned. Anwar Sadat thought and dreamed of leading Egypt through the ages. Menachem Begin, a little Polish ghetto boy, at garbage pails, thought about taking his country out of it. Golda Meir, how dare she? An old grandma with roll-down hose, a big nose. She should have been selling lox and bagels at Macy's. Instead, she dreamed of leading her country, a divorced, fat grandma, fantastically beautiful and brilliant, leading a country. Margaret Thatcher, 21, over her father's grocery store, dreaming about leading England. These targets begin very, very young, and they begin with children who can soar and fly, like you and I, with purpose. Now, the next point. Now, the next point is the key. Point number 8 is positive self-discipline. Positive self-discipline is doing within when you're without, and that's called simulation. Self-discipline is not sacrifice. It is doing within yourself when you are without that trait. So it's called synthetic experience or simulation. Simulation takes place in two forms, anticipation and response. So simulation is the synthetic living of the anticipated and response to the performance. Anticipated performance and response. And it is a relentless pursuit regardless of what happens in the performance, because the response simulation is as important as the anticipation. I've been looking at self-discipline, and it begins where goal setting leaves off. It is a fantastic thing, and the best way to show it is with slide. Let me show you this next slide, which is the basis for what I really believe in. That cycle is called the self-image, performance, self-talk, self-discipline cycle. If you have an imagined goal, self-direction, which is your self-image, and if you set it, of course you set it through self-talk. And self-talk is getting together in groups and in your car and before you go to bed with words, pictures, and emotions and gradually developing a concept. That's called anticipation simulation. So the self-talk leads to the self-image. The self-image, once set, determines the performance. The performance is either above or below or equal to your self-image. When you perform too well and you have a low self-image, your immediate response simulation is, that's not like me, just lucky, I guess, but I won't do it again. You confirm the low self-image. When you have a low self-image and do poorly, your response simulation is confirmation. Knew it would fail with my luck. That's the way it usually happens with me, doggone it. No matter how much I prepare, I usually work out that way, which is called a negative response simulation, which confirms the lower self-image. That's the losing self-discipline cycle. It's the habit of losing. The winner has a high self-image developed by positive self-esteem and self-talk and a creative imagination. The winner develops a high self-image and performs poorly. When the winner performs poorly, he or she says, that's not like me, target correction necessary, too far out of sight, time for bracketing, we need more theory, we need more practice, give me an instructor, give me a winner. The winner says, that's not like me, I'm better than that. The image stays up. The winner does well above their self-image. The winner says, that's more like it. Now we're getting somewhere. That's the way I usually hit it. Ivan Goolagong Kali has a high self-image about tennis. She hits the ball into the net. The immediate response is, get it over. You're better than that. Let's get moving. She hits it out of the baseline. Her self-talk is, bring it in. She hits a good shot. Now we're getting somewhere. The simulation goes, but people live up to that simulation if they're a winner or a loser. In studying athletes, astronauts, prisoners, children, I've looked at this performance and I believe it so greatly that I believe that you and I need to anticipate and respond to the way our performance is going. But don't try to get into your life at the performance cycle and grit your teeth and try too hard and shove it through. And the best example I can give you is with a bedwetter. Bedwetting is a relentless self-image, self-talk, performance cycle. The children, through self-talk of their parents and other things, somehow get the feeling that they're hand-me-down, or maybe they're insecure, or maybe they just get the habit. And then the self-image of a bedwetter sets in, and they automatically perform like an automatic sprinkler.
The self-talk afterwards is transferred by the parent. He should have seen what I did to my son. 6 years old, wet his bed every night. I looked at him and I gave him a response simulation. You bed wetter you, I'll get you in rubber pants and send you to the first grade. Big boys don't wet their bed. And then I gave him another simulation. No more liquid after 7 p.m. I made him eat dumplings and potatoes, but he made his own water out of dumplings and potatoes. The performance didn't work. Then I tried the last desperation, which is called get the salesman to perform. I'll take him and make him show him how to do it. Eat your squash. What I did with my son, I got him up in the middle of the night. I checked his diapers at 6 years old. Had to put them on him to see if he was dry. He was. My wife and I came in from going out. I went into his bedroom and I yanked him out of bed and stuffed him on the cold tile floor in his bare feet. He stood in his sleep. He learned how to stand in his sleep. He didn't once go there. He waited till he went back in bed where it's safe and warm. That's his place, not here. One night, though, he came into my living room, lifted up the best cushion on my chair. I said, don't go there, you're a chair wetter now. It doesn't work to perform better, not when your imagination and your self-talk have simulated you into performance. I crossed it off. I thought about going to the self-image, but I didn't have any music. I didn't have any suggestopedic this or that. I didn't understand it too well, so I went to the self-talk simulation. And instead of responding anymore as a bedwetter, we never again mentioned the word wet to him in his life. So response simulation was target correction already made. Anticipation simulation, very simple. What do you do when you're a child? You play let's pretend the night before. When you're a salesman, when you're an astronaut, when you're a leader, a mother. I took that six-year-old boy and anticipated Saturday morning, Friday night. On Friday evening, as he went to bed, I gave him his simulation for the night when he was receptive. I said, I love you so much. I'm sorry I haven't spent time with you. You're about the most special human being I've met, and I'd like to take you fishing, only I'd like to go with you tonight so we can get ready for tomorrow. The birds are singing, the sun is shining, you're warm and you're dry. It's 6 o'clock in the morning. You leap out of bed, pull your jeans on, we pack a lunch, get in the car, go down and on the boat, and catch lots of fish. Would you like to do that? He said, oh, Dad, I'd love to. I said, let's go, you and me. You ready? I said, you lie here and think about that. Warm and dry, birds singing, pull your pants on, get the lunch, go fishing. I sneaked in warm and dry a couple of times. But the real simulation was the fishing and the anticipation. The self-image took note, the robot went on, screwed down all the valves, and said, we're going fishing. Man the lifeboats, we're going fishing. He woke up in the morning, shoved his jeans on. You see, a bedwetter would have to wake up and go, uh-oh, put the pajamas in the hamper, get rid of the sheets. Oh, Dad will never let us go now. That's the simulation of a bedwetter. But a non-bedwetter gets it moving. He never wet his bed again. I've been doing it for 6, 7, 8, 14-year-olds. You name it, it works. Except one nurse said it worked for 4 nights and then it didn't work. I said, what did you tell your daughter in the morning? She said, I told her I was glad you didn't wet your bed. That's called the negative response simulation, looking at your backswing. You don't look at where you're coming from, you look at where you're going to, which is the new self-image. Football players. The new football playing way of simulation is in the locker room after you've done everything else on the field to make it work before the game, instead of pounding each other and saying, hey, 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 go hit them, kick them, slam them, jump them. You sit quietly before the game as you're getting ready, and you simulate the execution of your best game when you're relaxed. It builds in you a synthetic instinct, like a template, like a very soft etching that you'll try to follow through
and then your adrenaline pumps when you're on the field. The same with rowing, the same with skiing. Jean-Claude Killy, the skier, he says, I never get to ski in the real slalom course in the World Games until the actual day. And I said, well, how in the heck do you practice if you don't get to ski on the real one? He said, we ski on the practice one and get all limbered up and ready to go and keep coming down. It's great. I said, what do you do with the real one? He said, well, they have moguls that they don't want to get icy because they don't want to ruin the course. I said, what do you do? And he said, I go up there the evening before, just at sunset, and I watch it. And I said, and what do you watch? He said, I watch me coming out of the chute, feet together in the perfect execution. I never hit a flag, never miss a gate, 16.1 champion again. Bruce Jenner, Olympic decathlon, Montreal. What did he do? Bruce Jenner, decathlon champion, took the Russian decathlon champion's photograph out of the paper and snipped his head off and shoved a picture of himself there so he could see the gold medal around his neck and shoved it up over his bed for 4 years and just kept simulating as he went, Bruce Jenner champion gold medal. Now that's called the external simulation, but the internal simulation takes place like the Russian figure skater. She says, I practice this sequence so many times in my imagination I never fall. Stevie Coffin, the boy wonder jockey, 9 years old, in his yard. His father said, you shove that bale of hay in, stop daydreaming. Put that bale of hay in the wagon, son. And Stevie Coffin, age 9, said, as soon as I finish riding the Triple Crown, Dad, I'll be right with you. The Preakness, the Kentucky Derby, and the Belmont Stakes, when he was 9 years old, again and again and again. Simulation. Anticipation, response. I anticipate things will work out my way, and they don't. My response is, what's the answer? Give me the correction. What's the more information? How can I get it? I'm going there anyway. I bracket. The astronauts, Neil Armstrong. Do you think they'd ever gone to the moon before? No. How did we practice? Neil Armstrong was put in a life raft and bobbed around to simulate weightlessness. And then he flew the lunar excursion module up and down off the Mojave Desert. And then he flew it again and did it 300 times perfectly in his imagination. He got the job because his simulation was more perfect. And when he stepped on the moon, he said, one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. And then he said, just like drill, Shorty, just like drill. The synthetic rehearsal, like the man on the airplane, going to Chicago, humming to himself in the horizontal position. I turned the air vent on him and pushed the stewardess call button. I thought he was having an epileptic seizure. I said, excuse me, sir, are you all right? And he said, I beg your pardon. I'm an oboe player from the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'll get back to my symphony. I said, you're weird. He said, so are you. Now I got to start again. And if you think this is just so much talk, let me give you the last one. The last simulation is Colonel George Hall, Air Force Colonel, shot down North Vietnam, 5.5 years solitary confinement. He only gave name, rank, and serial number. He was a 6-handicap golfer. We use golf a lot, but it's just a sample. Colonel Hall, black pajamas, bare feet, walks back and forth across his cage, like animals at the Taronga Zoo, animals at the San Diego Zoo who get paranoid knowing they can't get out. 5.5 years every day, what would you do? Think. What would you think about? Winning or losing, take your choice, it's a habit. Colonel George Hall, knowing what he was faced with, drew upon the response simulation from everything he'd done before and drew upon his anticipation simulation, the desire to go home and do it again. and lived in his imagination for 5.5 years to go sane instead of going insane. What he did is played a round of golf every day for 365 days in his imagination. Four color fairway, blue tees, Titleist one. Take the swing 250 yards straight down Augusta National, and then Pebble Beach, and then Torrey Pines, and then all the rest of the courses. Second shot, close to the pin, 5-par hole, couldn't make it in 2. Replaced his divot, fixed his ball mark, checked the break of the ocean, putted in, broke a little too much, tapped it in, pulled the flag out, washed his ball. 5.5 years times 365 days, lost 77 pounds. His teeth weren't too good, 1 plate of rice. 100 push-ups, 200 sit-ups every day, another round of golf. A 6-handicapper he was, came back and played in the New Orleans Open 1 week after release, atrophy. Shaky, thin, gaunt. 1 week after release, 7 years in prison, 5.5 in solitary, shot a 76. 72 plus 4, right onto his handicap. The news media said, "Well, Colonel, congratulations on your new beginning re-entry luck." He said, "Luck, hell, I never 3-putted a green in 5.5 years. I said, "But sir, you didn't have a golf course." He said, "We all got one. The beautiful thing about your imagination is in your imagination, you never miss. You never say, 'You dumb klutz, there you go again, knew you'd blow it then.' You have an opportunity to play simulation to perfection while you practice and strain in the real course." I don't know how else to say it except that the winners I know do within when they're without, and they relax in their car, and they remember now that music at 60 beats per minute and relaxation and in the locker room and in your easy chair and in your bed and in front of the television set and as you're strolling and behind your desk late is the time to put in the first person present tense as if it had already been done, and the robot can't distinguish between something vividly imagined and that which really happened. It is the mark of a winner, which comes naturally to most, which I must struggle and learn, because I don't want to feel guilty in either not reaching my goal or in not feeling that I'm worthy of reaching it. I want to be comfortable in it, and so I play it in advance, synthetically. The psychology of winning, self-discipline.
The following are excerpts from Discussion Time from Winning in the 80s.
Dennis, what would you identify as the most important things in goal setting for whatever life we lead, whether we be interested in politics or business or whatever it is, whether we're male or female? What would you identify as the main things in goal setting to make those goals really work?
To define it. To define what it is, to be able to specifically specify it in terms of how big, how many, how much, where is it, what are the downside risks, what do you have to give up to get it. And I think definition is 90%. Most people don't ever get goals because they never take the time to set them. And then I still believe that old adage, beginning is half done. So I have seen most people, we had the goal setting session today, which was off the top of the head, but in our country, I find that 90% of the people will not tell you how much money they need, when they would like to retire, what salary they would like, where they would like to live, where their next vacation is, how they will get there, how much money it takes to get there. They won't do it. They think that some magical thing is going to happen to suddenly sweep them off their feet and into another beautiful port. And I still go back to the sea captain. The sea captain gets out his charts. He says, "You want to go to Singapore?" He says, "It's about this many miles. You're going to run through this many shoals. And are there any questions?" They get it all figured out, and he sets out. But then the fog sets in. For 90% of the voyage, he cannot any longer, or ever could, see Singapore. He only can see his illusion of it, as according to the chart. The wind blows him off course, he gets back on through tacking. He takes a celestial sight, gets target correction. He gets some more data. Nowadays, he gets on the radio and gets a weather report and gets another winner to help him get back on course. But it never has changed, and yet people are trying to find... What disturbs me the most is the people who expect life to take care of them. Now, I'm big in our country on welfare. In Salt Lake City, Utah, they won't allow anyone to draw a check who is capable of working. If you're capable of working, they will find you a job. And if you work, then they won't pay you if you physically and mentally are capable of holding a job done. And I don't know how they're getting away with it, but Salt Lake City, Utah has the lowest unemployment and the lowest welfare budget in the United States. And it's a model that I think other cities in our country should follow, which is challenging a person who can work to work.
Well, I noticed in your accreditations there that you've been honored by both houses of Congress. What would you say for people who are interested in politics is getting to the people, and how they get to the people, and how they convince people that their way is the right way?
Well, that's a good question. I think in being honored by both houses of Congress, I just went to talk to them and spoke to them, and we said what happened. You know, one of them asked me for some more rolls and butter. He thought I was the maitre d' in my sincere suit. But I think the politicians are more close to the problem, more close to the people, and I think that there's so much pressure on them because of the unionism representing the people, the blue-collar workers, and the pressure from industry and pressure from the all the sources of money, which is the sources of power, that they really have to do their homework, really have to know what's going on. And I don't think any politician would make any offhanded promise anymore and expect to be elected and stay elected, because we're finding it very difficult to get our goals because of the pressure groups and the interest groups that are pulling us apart. I think it's difficult to be a politician today, because regardless of how you'd like to help people, you make a promise, but oh, how difficult it is to deliver when you've got your factionism and special interest groups. And I can't relate to that because I'm not in politics or a good politician, but I think it's the same as any other walk of life, that this psychology of winning works the same way. Self-awareness, more potential than you thought. We're too worried. We're too fearful. We're too bent on the fact that it probably won't work. So we're defeated before we've begun. Self-esteem, we don't exude it. We're afraid to be set up on top. We don't want to distance ourselves from people. We don't feel worthy of success. We want to be humble. We've been taught to be humble. And so we don't lead with our best suit. We don't know how to accept compliments. We constantly throw them off. When people try to tell us something good, we say, "Don't mention it. It was nothing. I just got lucky. I was going to give it to the Goodwill. It's not a new suit. Has a moth hole right here." My dad was the best I've ever seen. I said to him, "How about a little Chivas Regal, Dad?" And he said, "Don't waste your good scotch on me, son." Imagine your own father not accepting the best when you think he's the best. That's a lifestyle that we are brought up to be selfless. And I think we need to set a model for others by being building a fine self to be given away in service. And I think more children and more workers need to understand and be proud that they're as deserving as any other human being on earth, but they have to work for it, because there's a responsibility for that. And that, how do they say, freedom isn't free. You have to pay the price and sacrifice, because freedom has never been free. I'm petitioning for a statue of responsibility to match the Statue of Liberty. I hope the Japanese give it to us. I don't think they will. The French certainly won't give us another Statue of Liberty. But I think it should stand on Alcatraz in San Francisco Bay, and whenever we talk about our freedoms and we demand our rights and we want this, and the Civil Liberties Union begins to talk about gay rights and they would like homosexual marriages and so on, that I think we ought to go to our statute of responsibility and ask them what the effect is going to be of that cause. And they'll tell us that we're liable to lose some freedoms by wanting a handout or something free.
Winning in the 80s continues on tape number 6.